Okay, good afternoon, everyone. And if you're stuck in the Eastern time zone like myself, good evening or good night. So I'm still struggling with that one. So as Marie mentioned, you know, she pretty much presented the design, the content, and the implementation of the survey. And what I'm going to focus on are the two modules that deal with anti-neoplastic drugs. And also, I just want to let you know at this point, the information I'm going to be presenting is, and in fact, for all of the survey data, it's descriptive information. We did not have any a priori hypotheses on this study. We just wanted to see what was out there. So what you're going to see is several tables of frequencies, somewhat boring, but, you know, nevertheless, I need to show those, you know, because I want to show the various types of exposure controls we've gathered information on. So the outline, I'm going to be discussing briefly the objectives, and those are the same objectives as you've seen before. And in fact, probably I could throw out a couple of slides because you've already seen them, but also provide you with health effects of and the national safe guidelines for hazardous drugs. And by the way, anti-neoplastic agents are a big part of the term hazardous drugs. Discuss just briefly the modules and who they were targeted to. And then the rest of this, the presentation will focus on the findings, the respondent demographics or their characteristics, and examples of and reasons for the lack of adherence to these guidelines, and concluding remarks, and then the publications that resulted from our study of anti-neoplastic agents. So if you've seen this, it's identical to the slide Marie had, and we probably should have coordinated a little bit, but nevertheless, it's good to show it again, okay? So, you know, we wanted to look at, you know, there's a number of chemical agents that are used in healthcare, and anti-neoplastic drugs are probably the most toxic of any chemicals that are used in healthcare and probably across industry. So, you know, it's very important, at least for oncology nurses, pharmacists, and pharmacy techs to adhere to these guidelines, to the letter of the law, really, because, you know, any type of exposure is serious. So with we wanted to evaluate the barriers to using recommended PPE. Now, we all know in the hierarchy of controls, PPE is down at the bottom. But when you look at anti-neoplastic agents and handling them, they're very important. You need to use PPE in addition to the engineering controls. So overall, we want to assess adherence to these recommended guidelines. But what I'm going to be presenting is, you know, showing you examples of lack of adherence. So, you know, just as a background on anti-neoplastic drugs, and from now on I'm going to call them chemo drugs, they're primarily used to treat cancer and other non-cancer medical conditions such as multiple sclerosis and arthritis. They're classified by NIOSH as hazardous drugs, and so in order to be classified as a hazardous drug, it has to meet one of six criteria, and that is carcinogenicity, teratogenicity, genotoxicity, reproductive toxicity, organ damage, and then if it's a new chemical, it has to be health effects, and have to be similar in structure and function as to the bad chemicals that you already characterized. There's probably 90 to 100 specific chemo drugs that are used in healthcare. We did get information on those, and we have it in our publications, you know, the ones that are most used to the ones that are least used. In terms of chronic health effects, you know, chemo drugs are a paradox. They cure cancer or put cancer in remission, but they also cause cancer. You can see what the other health effects are, the chronic health effects, the acute health effects, allergic type reactions, and skin rash. And, you know, since they are occupational carcinogens, it's recommended that exposures be kept as low as reasonably achievable. That's the LARA principle, which I'm sure you're all aware of. So, you know, there's authoritative guidelines out on chemo drugs, on hazardous drugs, of which most are chemo drugs. And these guidelines have been around for many, many years, since the mid-80s. So we're talking about guidelines from the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, Oncology Nursing Society, OSHA, and NIOSH. Okay, NIOSH has done a lot of work in this area. So it's with those four guidelines. I'll talk about USP in a little bit. But with those four guidelines, we looked at those guidelines and looked at the best practices and then formulated our questions. I included USP here because just in February of this year, they published guidelines. And although they had guidelines available previously and at the time of our survey, you know, this is chapter 795 and 797, they deal specifically with preparations of sterile and non-sterile drug preparations, okay? They don't deal at all with worker protection. Now, the USP guidelines that were issued in February, they are very geared toward worker protections. And they were published in February 2016, and they're going to not go into effect until July of 2018 because they want to give time for entities to comply. But one thing about the USP guidelines is that they're going to be enforceable by state pharmacy boards. So hopefully with that stick, there's better compliance. That's yet to be seen. Maybe we'll follow up with another survey. Who knows? But, you know, as you see here, they all specify, you know, specific practices and controls, exposure controls to use, you know, when handling chemo drugs. So we had the two modules, as Marie mentioned. The compounding module was targeted towards six professional practice organizations. So we had an organization who represented pharmacists, two that represented pharmacy techs, and three that represented oncology nurses. So one group was oncology nurses, infusion nurses, and then oncology hematology nurses. And then for administration module, it was those three groups that I mentioned for the nurses. So you've seen this before. I just wanted to point out that, you know, I mentioned that we looked at exposure controls. By exposure controls, I mean engineering controls, administrative controls that are primarily driven by the employer, work practice controls, which are employee-driven, and use of personal protective equipment. Also, other types of engineering controls, which are recommended for healthcare workers who handle chemo drugs, is medical surveillance and exposure monitoring. So this slide will look familiar for the next five or six slides. So in terms of the way it's set up. So we have the compounding module. And what we did is we wanted to differentiate between the nurses and pharmacy practitioners. The pharmacy practitioners are the pharmacists and pharmacy technicians. It had been 20 years since anybody has done any work looking at pharmacy practitioners, and we wanted to separate that and report on that in our publication, and that's what we did. But you can see to the left that, you know, we're characterizing the respondents by the number of respondents. So there was 422 respondents for the compounding module, 2,100 nurses who responded to the module on administering chemo. We characterize them by, you know, gender, age, race, years in occupation, years in a current employer, and their primary work setting. So when you look at the pharmacy practitioners, they're, you know, comparing them to the nurses who compounded, there's more males, they're a little bit younger, and they primarily worked in hospitals compared to ambulatory healthcare settings such as oncology clinics. When you look at the nurses who administered, Their profile is pretty much similar to the nurses who compounded, with the exception that they work primarily in hospitals versus ambulatory healthcare settings. Okay, so we asked about training. Training is very important, and it's specified that initial training be conducted, and that it be conducted annually thereafter. We asked whether they have ever received training, and if they had received training, whether it was within 12 months or beyond 12 months, and then we asked them about the availability of employer safe handling procedures. And you can see what the percentages are, the proportions of workers who reported that. I don't know if I need to go into every one of these, but you know, you can see that. Okay, engineering controls. You know, the guidelines specify that for compounding chemo drugs that you do that in a dedicated room, and typically in the hospital it's in the pharmacy, you know, and probably in a separate room in the pharmacy where the BSC is. So they also specify that compounding is done in a BSC. So it kind of depends on whether or not it's sterile or non-sterile, but it's either a type 1 or type 2. For compounding and administration of chemo, a closed system drug transfer device is always recommended. And that type of device, as you see here, I don't know if it's very clear, but that device prevents contamination of the product in the system and also release of chemo drug out of the system. So, and there's a lot of work being done by NIOSH on looking at the various chemo or the various CSTDs that are out there right now, looking at how effective they are and doing what they're supposed to do. And then lastly, we looked at Luralac connections, and those are basically leak-free connections. And you can see that roughly 10% of the healthcare workers who compounded did the compounding in a dedicated room. You know, the BSC was used either 10 or 20% depending on nurses or pharmacy practitioners. You know, 75% of the nurses who compounded did not use a CSTD. Half of the pharmacy practitioners did not always use the CSTD, which I found quite surprising. And then half of the nurses who administered did not always use the CSTD. And you can see what the percentages are there for Luralac connections. Now, we looked at a number of different practices, and, you know, the publications contain a lot more information than what I'm presenting here. But, you know, I just have here three that I thought to include. And, you know, when you prime IV tubing, the recommendation is you prime it with a non-drug liquid such as saline, not chemo drug. However, we see that using chemo drug was reported by, you know, roughly 5-10% of the respondents. And the other two issues are pretty much self-explanatory. You know, you don't want to take home potentially contaminated clothing, and they indicated that they had done that. And, you know, typically when you wear chemo gloves, hopefully double clink chemo gloves, that when you remove them, you wash your hands, and we see that that wasn't done either. So, you know, the recommendation is wear double chemo gloves. You can see that that wasn't the case, you know. Even wearing single chemo gloves wasn't the case. You know, roughly 10 to 15% of the respondents said they didn't even wear chemo gloves when doing compounding or administration of the chemo. The other recommendation is you always wear an impervious gown. You know, we asked about the guidelines, the best practice was what you see here, you know. Yet, you know, that wasn't the case. You know, you had, as you see here, 20, 40% of those who compounded and 42% of who administered did not always use, you know, an impervious gown. And we followed up for those who indicated that they did not use chemo gloves or an impervious gown. We asked them to select from a list of questions as to why you know, they didn't do that. And that list of responses was developed in coordination with our focus groups, you know. So we got responses from the actual practitioners. But, you know, in terms of the gloves, you know, the top reasons, even though the N is small, and the reason the N is small is because most of them indicated they wore, you know, chemo gloves, what, 85% or so. But, you know, they said exposure was minimal, not provided by employer, you know, skin, not part of our protocol, you know, that was for gloves. For gowns, not part of our protocol, skin exposure was minimal, you know, engineering control was used. Well, you know, this is, conveys a perception among the workers that, you know, what they're dealing with isn't that big of a deal. It's no different than any other chemical. And we all know that that's not the case. We asked about, you know, when they used the gloves, whether or not after they compounded or administered chemo, what did they do with the gloves? You know, whether or not they touched work surfaces, you know, and this presents shows the information for the healthcare workers who compounded the chemo drugs. You know, they used a pen or pencil outside of the lab hood. You know, I mean, if they use that and it stays in the lab hood, fine. You know, that's a contaminated area. When they use it outside of the lab hood, you know, that's a different situation. They indicated that, you know, 37% or so said they touched doorknobs, you know, touched waste baskets. They're touching objects, you know, that, you know, what that means is that they're cross-contaminating other areas. And then you may have workers who are not protected go into those areas, and then they get chemo on their hands, and, you know, there's exposure that results. We asked the same questions of the nurses who administer chemo. You know, 61% said they touched the IV pump on or bed controls, you know? And, you know, in that case, you may have people other than the healthcare worker, like family members or visitors or, you know, other people in the area that can inadvertently touch these things and, you know, become contaminated. We asked about spills and spill response. So we asked about whether or not they had a spill in the past week and whether they were always cleaned up. And then we also asked whether or not spill kits were available. And you could see, you know, that you had respondents indicate that, you know, they did have a spill in the past week, and some indicated that they didn't always clean it up. And you scratch your head on that one. It could have been in a lab hood, but, and then that spill kits were not always available. And then, you know, that's something that falls on the employer, obviously. We asked about skin contact and, you know, whether they incurred a Sharps injury. And you can see what the percentages are here. I get a warning, 2 minutes, okay? I don't want you guys to hang around any longer than you need to. Okay, and then I have two more slides dealing with, you know, employer or administrative controls. So we asked whether or not, now the guidelines state that for any healthcare worker who compounds or administers chemo, they must be in a medical surveillance program. You can see here that very few indicated that they participate in the program, and a lot of them indicated that they did not, their employer did not even have a program, you know. And then we ask about exposure monitoring. So by exposure monitoring, I mean wipe sampling, which is probably what they do most of versus air sampling, because most chemo drugs are not very volatile. But you can see that most of them, 80%, 8 out of 10, indicated that, you know, they didn't do any exposure monitoring, or they didn't even know if they did or not. So, you know, let's talk about reasons for lack of adherence. You know, I have those listed here. Some of those came from the survey. Some of those came from the literature, you know. And, you know, we had a colleague in our office that took some of the data and looked at predictors of adherence to chemo drugs, okay? And she found that Sharon Silver. She found that training, the familiarity with safe handling guidelines, the availability of PPE were associated with better adherence to safe handling practices, okay? And another colleague, David DeJoy with the University of Georgia, he's on our sector council, he said, Jim, when are you going to look at the health and safety perception questions? I said, I have a lot of other stuff to get out before I even go down that road. He says, look, can I take it on? Can we have a collaborative agreement? I said, sure. So he took that on and looked at the safety climate questions that were in a core module and looked at the practices to see where there was any correlation. And, you know, he saw that there was that positive safety climate and other organizational factors were strong predictors of engineering control use and PPE use. You wouldn't, you know, you say, okay, duh, you know, that's what you would expect. But a lot of people, you know, don't put two and two together. And, you know, I just want to say that probably the biggest indicator I would think that would be a positive safety climate within an organization. You need top down, you know, directives in terms of what's important. So, you know, the one thing about chemo drugs is that I mentioned earlier that these guidelines have been available for close to 30 years, yet despite that, we're seeing that there's breaches in following the best practices, the guidelines that are out there. And what's needed is commitment from all levels of the healthcare organizations to ensure that there's universal adoption of these best practices. You know, I feel that additional studies are needed to evaluate factors which prevent the use of safe handling guidelines. I think more information is needed out there. These are the publications that resulted from our work focusing on chemo drugs. And another one's going to be coming out soon by David DeJoy that's going to be looking at safety climate issues. And then also we're going to be, as Marie mentioned, we're going to have a website, a NIOSH website, that presents all the publications in a short summary of what we found. Okay, so that's kind of like a one-stop shopping for the information we found on the survey. Here's a project team. I just wanted to point out Rebecca Zai, who's over there, and she took the lead on the module that addressed respiratory aerosolized medications that was targeted toward respiratory therapists. Thanks a lot. Any questions, I guess? Okay. All right.
As someone who put themselves through college working in two hospitals, as a pharmacy tech, taking IVs and compounding sometimes hazardous drugs, thank you. Because the first thing I did when I went to and got an occupational health in school, my first project was to go to an oncology department and do wide sampling. And by the way, also look at nurses practicing of emptying IV bags into the toilet. In the bathroom. But I think this is really great, and I want to then think about, now I'm in my role, is how can we get hospitals? And the USP is probably directed towards compounding, but the administration is a big issue too, because you have a lot of women at pregnancy age working in these situations. And I look towards either Joint Commission, because they listen to whatever, and also state licensed hospitals, and I've considered approaching our licensing facility board to talk about these requirements.
Right. Well, let me point this out, that the USP guidelines do cover compounding and administration. They do both, yeah. And, you know, the fact that, you know, they're going to be those guidelines are going to be mandated by state pharmacy boards. I think that's a big deal. So, and then also NIOSH is working with the Joint Commission. Tom Connor, who's the chemo guru within NIOSH, he's working with them to come out with a white paper. And then also, There was another issue that I wanted to bring up, but it's kind of like, but it might come back. Yes. I know that. Yeah. Well, you know, when we first started with this, and then the decision was to, you know, I'll just step back a little bit. You know, I think you're referring to the National Occupational Exposure Survey. Okay. This was a survey we did last in the early 80s, and it was an on-site survey. And initially with this, we wanted to see whether or not it was feasible to do an on-site survey and get at this information. It wasn't, okay? And that's why we went with a web-based survey. And it was the appropriate tool to use for healthcare workers, as Marie mentioned. I mean, because they're computer whizzes, yeah. For other industries, perhaps not. And I think Bob Harrison asked me that question in our sector council meeting, like, are you going to do another nose? I said, no. No, I just don't see it happen. It's just too expensive. But we need to evaluate other means of doing something like that. For example, now, as compared to back in the early 80s, there are material safety data sheets out in the workplace. So employers have this information, but the question is how we get it and then how we link that to occupations, the workers that use these chemicals in the workplace. There's a lot of questions, yeah. Okay, sure.
Even though the majority of the people that we got a lot of people to respond, but there were subsections or subpopulations within this group that we couldn't get email addresses from. And they probably wouldn't. So a lot of the folks who handled the high level disinfection are they the sterilists are not
you know, right. Like we had a module on cleaning and disinfecting agents, and we could not go forward with that because we could not identify. We thought we could go with the unions who represent those workers, but they did not have a centralized repository for email addresses for their members. And so we kind of had to put that off the side. But let me say this. With our website, we are going to post the publications in addition to posting the survey instruments. Okay? Yeah. Any other questions? Yes. No, we didn't follow up that response with a question like, you know, why was that?
I mean,
yeah. Both. Yeah, definitely.
There were so many people who said it's not in our protocol that it raised a lot of red flags that really that probably the employers did not have the protocol themselves. I can't imagine that they didn't know about the guidelines. They just were not.
But what we require them to do is store chemical safely.
think it's in our, as a state, in our purview to be able to require that they use, follow what the guidelines are. But the USP is something we can know. I mean, even though the, our board of pharmacy, but it's easy to...
The other thing comes to mind now, that NIOSH is going to be putting out another alert. So the alert they put out was in 2004, and incidentally, NIOSH updates the list of hazardous drugs every 2 years. But the alert, the new alert's going to be very comprehensive. They wanted to call it a CIB, a current intelligence bulletin, but they decided to keep it named the same just so that people don't lose sight of things. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to wrap it up and say we have to go. There's still some sessions.